Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Paul Cienfuegos. Paul is a national leader in the community rights movement, which works to dismantle corporate constitutional so-called rights and assert the people's inherent right to govern themselves. He's been leading workshops across the U.S. since 1995. David Barsamian's internationally syndicated show, Alternative Radio, has broadcast five of his speeches. Launched in October 2017, Paul is the founding director of Community Rights U.S. Paul has just published his first book titled, How Dare We? Courageous Practices to Reclaim Our Power as Citizens. He lives in Portland, Oregon. More info at www.communityrights.us. So first off, thank you for your decades of wonderful work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks, you too. So I know that the last time I interviewed you, I said this to you too, but I just want to say again that, you know, even when I was a little baby activist, you were one of my heroes. You are a force for nature and a force for democracy and community rights. And I honestly think that if there was a hall of fame, an activist hall of fame like there is for baseball, I think you would be in Cooperstown.
That's very sweet and kind of you. Thank you.
Okay, so your big deal is and has been community rights. And what does that mean?
Well, I wanted to kind of come up with some kind of prepared outline of what it really means to me so that I don't find myself stumbling in this part of the conversation. So I actually prepared something that I'm going to share that will just take a number of minutes to read that answers that question in the way that I wanted to answer it today. First, we would need to get our heads around a much deeper understanding of the structural causes of why our society ends up with so many stupid policies, like becoming massively dependent on nuclear and fossil fuels to power our society, rather than shifting towards a zero-growth, steady-state economy, or why we end up with an agricultural model that's dependent on massive single-crop landscapes requiring massive chemical and fossil fuel-derived pesticides, causing massive loss of topsoil and groundwater contamination. Or why we end up with a healthcare system, if you can even call it that, that profits from sickness instead of health and is utterly unaffordable for so many people. Or why we end up with a set of foreign and military policies that prioritize vast profits from war and occupation of other sovereign nations, rather than policies that genuinely make the world a safer place for the world's people and other species. Same exact problem regarding our society's relationships to forests, to taking care of children and elders, to the homelessness emergency, to the climate emergency, et cetera, et cetera. So in each of these cases, we got numerous single-issue advocacy groups working hard to try to make a meaningful difference without ever acknowledging to themselves or to their sometimes millions of supporters that their tactics and strategies are utterly ineffective at creating real societal change. And I would argue, and the community rights movement would argue, that we don't have a fossil fuel energy crisis, we have a democracy crisis. We don't have a toxic agriculture crisis, we have a democracy crisis. We don't have a healthcare crisis, we have a democracy crisis, and so for our foreign intervention policy, our climate emergencies, etc. These are all mere symptoms of a lack of real democracy in this country. So in every one of these examples, the concerned public is carved up into hundreds, if not thousands, of single-issue emergency response groups. So an emergency like the imminent extinction of various wild salmon species in the Pacific Northwest and Canada becomes just another urgent single-issue campaign to try to get an overwhelmed and shell-shocked public to pay attention. The power holders, the 0.1% corporate and government leaders, want as little interference as possible from the rabble. That's what they call us, we the people. So as long as we the people carve ourselves up into these thousands of emergency response single-issue groups, we are out of the way and impotent, which is exactly where they want us. So the response has to be twofold, in my opinion. Number one, whatever single issue each of us is paying closest attention to needs to be reframed as soon as possible as a mere symptom of the larger lack of democracy emergency, i.e., key societal decisions on that issue are being made by the wrong people, usually corporate boards of directors. Instead, we need new forms of pressure being mobilized to question the very legitimacy of how these decisions are being made and by whom or by what. So that if you're looking on ending our nation's dependence on fossil fuels, you entirely shift gears away from the various tactics and strategies that keep losing and towards new tactics and strategies, or more accurately, very old tactics and strategies that were so successfully practiced and perfected during the American Revolution, when the villagers of Massachusetts and other early U.S. colonies stopped begging the king to cause them less harm and instead started to entirely withdraw their consent by delegitimizing the existing decision makers who were all appointed by the king, county councilors, local judges, etc. So in other words, instead of pleading with corporate and government leaders who keep making bad policies, you withdraw your consent from them holding leadership positions at all. And you instead democratize and localize that decision making. So that's number one of the two actions that are urgent. The second one is, the second action, is that you do a massive amount of reaching out to and educating the local public where you live to help to empower them to understand their rightful decision-making authority as we the people, as the sovereign people, that we the people actually have the legitimate constitutional authority to govern ourselves whenever our government is no longer making decisions that have what's called, quote, the consent of the governed, unquote. That language is found in most state constitutions. So, for example, in the Oregon Constitution, the very first article, Article 1, says the following. We declare that all men, when they form a social compact, are equal in right, that all power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their peace, safety, and happiness, and they have at all times a right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in such manner as they may think proper. That's the first article of my state's constitution in Oregon. It's quite extraordinary, but nobody really takes it seriously anymore. And you can find similar language in most state constitutions. You can find it in the Declaration of Independence. Here's an excerpt from that. It says, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. That's from 1776. And then one last example of this in our history, Abraham Lincoln, in his inaugural address, so we're talking about his first few minutes as president of the United States, he said, quote, this country with its institutions belongs to the people who inhabit it. Whenever they shall grow weary of the existing government, they can exercise their constitutional right of amending it or their revolutionary right to dismember or overthrow it. It's hard to imagine an existing modern president saying that in their inaugural address. Now they're just threatened by we the people. You notice what naturally begins to happen when lots of single issue advocacy groups begin to make this profound shift in their tactics and strategies. All of a sudden, you're all doing identical pro-democracy work. You're all breaking out of your single issue emergency response activism cages. You're all reclaiming your rightful place at the decision-making table. And once you both educate people effectively and empower them, everything can change. Then we can actually start mobilizing ourselves a lot more effectively and get down to actually solving real-world problems such as, for example, do we want to protect clean air and water for all living beings? Yes, of course we do. Do we want to grow and eat food that isn't poisoned? Yes, of course. Do we want healthy salmon populations to return to our rivers and oceans? Yes, duh, of course. So then what are we going to do about it? And so I've been excited about this conversation with you for a while because you've been just so focused on salmon as an essential, I don't know if you call it a totem species, but I've seen it referred to in that way, that it's an absolutely core species of this part of the planet, and that if we can't save a species that is absolutely central to the survival of the natural world in this area, we might as well just throw in the towel. What would it look like if we, the people of the Pacific Northwest, let's say communities around, you know, the lowest dam in the Columbia River ecosystem, for example, what would it look like if we started taking ourselves seriously as members of this body that actually is we the people, the sovereign people, people who are withdrawing our consent from a government that is not protecting this absolutely essential totem species? What would it look like if we just said, okay, we the people of this part of this river ecosystem are going to do it ourselves. We're going to take the dam down. We're not going to wait for the federal government to make excuse after excuse anymore, to be literally they're barging salmon around dams, et cetera, et cetera. So anyways, I wanted to start with that kind of frame for how I see single issue activism and why I think it has to be completely rethought out.
So I have a whole bunch of responses to this.
Great.
I'm going to, a couple of them are questions. I think I have four responses in my head right now. One of them is, what can you define community? Two is, can you define democracy? And then three is a negative thing, and four is a positive thing. And the negative thing is, I remember decades ago, Wes Jackson said to me, didn't say to me, he said to, there was a group of like 10 or 20 of us, and he said to the group that Walmart is the main thing keeping the United States from revolution at that point. This is the 90s or early 2000s. Walmart is the main thing keeping the United States from revolution because they're providing cheap diapers to people. And so there's the question of, when you have a public that is more interested in consumerism than saving the planet, is democracy necessarily then a good thing? And I'm not trying to push your answer any direction with that. I'm just saying. But then on the other hand, as you were talking about our communities, I remember back in 1991 or so, there was a some sort of Pacific Power Planning Commission public input meeting about the dams on the Columbia. And this was 30 years ago when was to let everybody know how little has happened since then. And it was very interesting because the place was an auditorium that was packed and people start giving their opinions. And I got up and gave my opinion, which was that exactly what you're saying, that we are members of this community, this larger biotic community. And if you, Pacific Power Planning Commission, and you, government, etc., don't take out the dams, we in our community will need to, because we need to act. And so either you do it or we do it. It doesn't really matter. And it was kind of cool because a whole bunch of people got up after that and said they support the Jensen alternative. But the thing that was really interesting is that of all the people who spoke that night, all but two were in favor of dam removal. And those two, one of them was a representative of Pacific Power, or whatever its name was at that point. And the other was, I don't remember what the other person was, somebody from the board, the Corps of Engineers. I don't know. I don't remember where they were from. But anyway, it was like 98-2. And a couple things. One is, of course, the newspaper reported it the next day as saying great controversy over what should happen and quoted two people on each side. But the real point is it was 98-2. So I've got an anti-democracy thing that, you know, I think a lot of people are more interested in consumerism than salmon, probably. And then on the other hand, we have all the people who showed up who were 98%, really, I mean, close enough to 98% opposing the dams and wanting them removed today. So take any of this any direction you want.
So much good stuff to respond to. So juicy. Thank you. So yes, I mean, obviously our society, you know, has led the world, has led the charge in turning us all from citizens to consumers, no question about it. But that was very, very planned. That was planned by the 0.1% who've been making decisions for us forever. And they've been trying to get us to believe ourselves that the way that we, that the most effective activism that we can do is as consumers, to vote with our dollars. Because if we vote with our dollars, they tell us, we are participating powerfully. But the reality is just the opposite. That's exactly where they want us. So, you know, if you look at it through a community and corporate rights lens, and you understand something about the legal history, the legal and structural history of how this country got so screwed up. And I wish I could quote the actual case name, but I just remember the basics. And I believe it was in Florida that the state of Florida many, many decades ago, before Walmart was a real thing, and chain stores, big chain stores were just starting to appear on the landscape. The state of Florida tried to pass a law that taxed chain stores at a massively higher rate than local stores. And of course, they were struck down by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional because it violated some kind of corporate constitutional right. But before corporations, and there's been a whole series of literally hundreds of Supreme Court decisions about pushing more and more constitutional rights, corporate personhood, and other rights for these giant business entities. And so this is like, you know, this is hidden history. It's just hidden in plain sight, this history. There were decisions in the mid to late 1800s where states were trying to ban large corporations from manufacturing products in their state, or selling them in their state, or even passing the produced item through their state for sale in another state, because they understood already that this would have dramatic negative impact on local economies. So there's been this, you know, 205 year or something history now, 203 year history since 1819, of the U.S. Supreme Court siding with the desires of the corporate elite to shrink and shrink and shrink what's allowed, what we the people and our local and state governments are allowed to do. So when you say, you know, people care more about consuming than they do about saving the salmon, that's absolutely right. But there's an institutional and structural explanation for that. It's not just that people are stupid. They've been dumbed down. They've been turned into consumers in a very focused, organized campaign. And so at this point, we the people don't realize our own power. And of course, when the media then reports it the way that you described that they did, that's no surprise either, because that's another giant corporation. And it has its own particular interests, which are completely different than the interests of the public. So, you know, I always think of this, because I've been doing this work for decades, I think of this through a community rights lens. Like, what are the institutional changes that happened that dumbed us down, turned us into consumers, and made us not pay attention? You know, and then you add on top of that, that most people in this country today are just scrambling for basic economic survival. You know, one income used to provide a living wage for a whole family. Then it was two incomes. Now it's like sometimes three people in a household are working full time just to cover basic expenses. Who in the hell is going to be participating in an advocacy group, or try to protect democracy, or try to protect workers' rights, or try to protect salmon, when they can barely, you know, they're so tired they can barely chew their food when they come home at night? Right. Again, and these are structural. There are structural explanations for why, you know, we the people are poorer and poorer and poorer. It's not our own fault, right? There are decisions have been made by the ruling elite for centuries that create this. So, I mean, that's what I would say is that, and that's why what I said in my opening monologue is that public education, you know, popular education, like Paulo Freirean type popular education, is an essential part of this. you know, and it's an essential part of getting single issue activists out of their little cages, which, you know, as I found out in the last 2+ decades of doing this work, is really hard.
Well, I'm thinking on a couple levels. I'm thinking of a term, I don't remember who came up with it, that is primary emergency. And that's that if you're, I mean, for a woman, there is for a woman, especially who has been sexually assaulted, there is a decent chance that she will go into work to prevent men from sexually assaulting women. Or if one's family has been exploited in labor, then that might be one's primary emergency, as opposed to working on salmon. And then it becomes even more dire when you have all members of the family have to, I mean, when your primary emergency is putting food on the table, as opposed to, and I'm going to use a negative term here, but I don't mean it, as opposed to spot pie in the sky community organizing.
Sure.
You know, it's like, rather have pie on the table than it ends up. And I just want to say, you know, I'm saying this, and I'm thinking of what I wrote in Culture of Make Believe about how when a new wave of immigrants would come to the United States, so often, instead of working in working class solidarity to raise all of the workers, they would be in competition with the people who had come just a generation earlier. And you can't blame the individuals for this, because, you know, you've got 4 kids, one of whom has already died of starvation, and I have a choice of either acting nobly or using the fact that I am Irish and not black to gain a job. Yeah. I can totally see why you would use the fact that you're Irish and not Romanian, or the fact that you're Romanian and not Polish, or the fact that you're Polish and not black, or the fact that you're black and not, I can totally see how the workers would do that, because we're talking about life and death here.
Exactly. And divide and conquer has always worked. And now it's workers versus environmentalists, for example. You know, that's a modern use of divide and conquer. You know, and now Republicans and Democrats are supposed to hate each other in our current political insanity.
So there's just one more thing I want to throw out having to do with democracy, that it's, I'm only throwing this out because I'm reading a book right now about the history of the Mississippi River from 1800 to 1850. And I just came across this fact that I had no clue until 2 nights ago, which is, in some of the rural counties of Mississippi, enslaved African people outnumbered whites by about 50 to 1. And most of the, it wasn't like Gone with the Wind where the people are living on a plantation. Instead, most of the actual owners of the land and the people were absentee landowners who might live in, I mean, they might live in Chicago for all we know. The point is that number 50 to 1. So what would democratization have done to democratization where black people count as real people? What would that have done to the entire system of slavery? And I don't know if this is the direction you want to go. It's just, I was blown away to learn that the ratio was 50 to 1.
Yeah, that is shocking. I think you only need to look at the Reconstruction period in the Deep South to understand what it would look like when you democratize a state, because all of a sudden black people are voting, and all of a sudden there are black people in the state legislature, and there are black people as mayors. And they're black people as judges for what, like 10 or 15 years. And then the counterforce begins, the backlash begins, which, you know, you see in the very, very end of the Gone with the Wind film, you know, where all these black people who are now empowered are, you know, lazy idiots who just sit with their bare feet on their desks in the state legislature eating watermelon. I mean, it's an unbelievable racist imagery. But the white people were convinced that that was, I mean, it was a threat. It was a profound threat, and it had to end. But that's what happened very quickly when the majority of people, i.e. black people, actually had political power for the first time. And I didn't, you asked other questions too, just very brief response to the democracy one. Democracy is based on two words, demos and kratia, C-R-A-T-I-A, which basically translates as rule by the people. That's why a lot of people say we're not a democracy, we're a democratic republic. We're not ruled by the people, we're ruled by representatives of the people. But if you look at the 27 states in the United States where the public can actually put a ballot initiative on the ballot and people can vote on it and change the law, regardless of what the state legislature or the local city council wants, that actually is ruled by the people. It's constantly under attack by state legislatures. For example, Oregon, we have some of the most open ballot initiative rules in the country, and yet the state legislature forbids local communities from passing laws about all sorts of things through what's called state preemption, right? Because it's a threat. Portland can't pass rent control laws to protect renters because the state legislature preempts it, and a vast number of our Democrat state legislators are landlords of properties that are rented residentially, and none of them has to recuse themselves as a conflict of interest. And so we can't get local rent control. The entire system is just, it's gross from top to bottom. But I really want to focus in the time remaining on what would it look like if we used the democratic process and we threw these shackles off and we got our heads out of our asses in these single issue urgent response cages. And we thought about, like, what would it actually look like if, let's say, we, the people of the Lower Columbia River, decided to take out all the dams, right? And help salmon survive. I mean, can I kind of share some of the thoughts that I had about what those early conversations would look like and kind of get your feedback to?
Oh, please, because I mean, this issue I think is really important. And I mean, the issue of the salmon, and B, whenever I talk with you or with any community rights activist, I really agree with what you're saying. Well, and frankly, it's when I talk to myself about all the issues I talk about civilizations inherently unsustainable, et cetera, et cetera. The difficult question is, how do you get from point A to point B?
Right.
And, you know, it's nice that I got all these books of theory, and it's nice that you spout this theory, and I'm not using spout pejoratively because I said it about myself too. But then how does it work? So yes, I would love it if you did that.
And I'm not going to claim that any of this is easy, and it requires that almost everybody who is doing some kind of activism, which is almost definitely single issue activism, shifts the way that they're doing that activism. And it doesn't mean that they stop working on the issue that they care about. It means they stop working on it in the way that they're working on it.
Wait.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to say another thing about this, that, you know, you're talking about propositions, and California has very positive proposition laws too. Another, you know, sort of having to do with the democracy thing is that, you know, Northern California is known for marijuana. They pushed through Prop 215, which was pretty popular. That was the medical marijuana one. And yep. Then they, you know, there was popular support for legalization. So the proposition went through, but the way legalization actually happened was completely controlled by what some people call the canocrats, and it was controlled by the big moneyed interests.
Corporations.
So
they actually were corporations again.
So my point is that this single issue, you have somebody, I want to legalize marijuana, and they, you know, that's what they're working on, but it's so easy if you're working on that single issue to then actually end up carrying the water for the corporations, because in the case of the marijuana legalization, it's been a complete disaster for family farmers. And my point here is that even when there's a democratic impulse, or when the people want to speak, we can use this proposition tool, but every time it's going to be jerked around because we're not seeing this larger community rights part of it. Instead, we're just, let's legalize marijuana, let's do this, let's do that. And it ends up having a result that is kind of the opposite of what we were hoping for.
I obviously have a lot to say in response to that too. So first off, the people who organized the cannabis initiatives, especially the recreational ones that followed the medicinal ones, those people were the people who actually wanted to get rich. They wanted to be the first ones across the finish line with their corporations consolidating massive profits in giant warehouses. So I worked hard, completely unsuccessfully, in Oregon and California way back when, to try to say to the folks writing the language, you need to ban business corporations from involvement at any level in the growing distribution, marketing, and retailing of marijuana products, period. You could have put that in the initiatives, in the ballot initiatives, and we would have a completely different outcome. But the people who were pushing it wanted to be rich. That's a problem. Two, let's not miss a really key fact here, which is that the medical marijuana Prop 215 in California violated the law, even though it was put on the ballot and even though it was passed by California voters. It violated federal preemption laws. It still does. State sales of marijuana or growing of marijuana still violates federal marijuana prohibition laws. It happened anyway because we, the people of California, decided that we would push back on an unjust federal law and create a new state law. And so even though that law was illegal then and is illegal now, they used the state ballot initiative to do it because they were challenging what they considered an unjust law. Same situation here with the salmon, right? As we have feds that are trying to ameliorate the loss of salmon by barging salmon around dams saying that's good enough. You can't do anything else because we preempt. These dams are under federal control, so back off. There's nothing you can do. But that's, again, ridiculous because as all of those historical documents make very clear that I shared earlier in this conversation, when consent of the governed is no longer taking place, government is no longer acting legitimately, and we can reform or abolish that and move forward as we, the people, governing ourselves. Back to the salmon topic that I really want to focus on with you because it's such a passion of yours and mine. So what would it look like? What would we do? What would we, the people, do to bring a healthy salmon population back to a section of river that's dammed? Here's just the beginnings of that conversation, and I'd like to develop it more with you. I think it would be really cool if the two of us could take this to a part two and maybe do a live stream a couple weeks after this is broadcast on YouTube or on Google or however those things work and have a conversation with whoever, you know, calls in. What would it look like if we developed an urgent action plan for every river that's dammed and is therefore blocking wild salmon runs? What sorts of experts are out there who we already trust, who we would want to work with to give us expert information, advice? How much would removal of a major dam on the Columbia River cost? And how would that money be pulled together? The public regularly is asked to pass bonds through the ballot box, state bonds, to pay for major public expenditures. This is clearly a public expenditure. We have eminent domain laws in this country, which are supposed to be used to protect a public good, and seizing a property from a private person, but also could be a private from a corporation, for a public good. So might you have a ballot initiative that uses eminent domain to seize the dam from the authority of the federal government? What would a working timeline look like? What would it look like for people who have expertise in removal of dams? Some major dams, like on the Elwha and other rivers in the United States, have come down in the last handful of years. What can we learn from the people who are actually involved in the planning and the demolishing and of those dams? And what can we learn for, like I know in the Elwha Dam, which was, you know, inside Olympic National Park on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State, I know that the salmon returned way faster than anyone had predicted, and that's usually what you hear when dams are removed. So what's a working timeline? You know, that would start to make this more real. Would we want to give the federal government one last brief chance to do the right thing before we take over the project from the federal government? You know, okay, federal government, you have 6 months or 12 months to initiate this much very specifically defined of a dam removal plan, or we will take over on this date. What kinds of democratic structures would we use? Would we organize just very well facilitated and marketed citizen assemblies in every community that was at all close to these dams or benefiting from or impacted by these dams? Would we use local or county or state ballot initiatives? Would we pass public bonds to pay for it? Which voters would be involved in the vote? The dams currently serve certain constituencies. One of the reasons that there's still a number of dams on the Lower Columbia River is that there are barges that bring grain downriver from industrial scale grain farms in eastern Oregon and eastern Washington. But there's now so few of these barges, it's like literally it's a couple barges a month. And that's the only reason left for some of these dams on the Columbia River. So could the grain be moved in a different way, right? If we, the people, started taking ourselves seriously, which we don't do, we would have these conversations. Go for it.
Or yeah. If it's only a couple of barges, honestly, you could pay the farmers they have paid farmers not to grow before.
Right.
So you could pay the farmers by the amount of soil they grow on the Palouse.
Exactly. And this grain is going down the river because it's for export. It's for being barged down to a major tanker somewhere to another country. So don't export the damn grain. Right? Move it on trucks from eastern Oregon to a point in the United States that will use it, right? I mean, but the point is that right now, corporate boards of directors and our federal government have decision-making authority over every single part of the conversation. And we, the people, are in locked rooms begging, lobbying, demanding as the powerless. And we're only powerless because we see ourselves as powerless, right? It's learned powerlessness. It's learned helplessness, right? It doesn't have to be that way. And so 20 plus years, I've been leading workshops to help people to imagine what it would look like if we, the people in a local place, actually started imagining that we are the decision makers that we've been waiting for.
That sounds, that sounds delightful. And also there's a part of me that thinks that sounds kind of scary because it's so much easier to go to the Pacific Power Planning Commission meeting and say, we need to remove the dams, and then go back home and think, wow, I spoke up for the salmon. I did my job.
Exactly.
And now somebody ought to do something, as opposed to...
And if they don't do it, we'll be mad rather than active.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I'm still mad at them 30 years later.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the salmon have continued to die. And meanwhile, I have not done the things that you've said.
But you did, like your example, which you shared with me in this conversation and the last time we were recorded in a conversation about you standing up and the Derek Jensen alternative. What a great story. And if you had had a better sense of how to move that idea forward when 98 out of 100 people in the room wants the dam removed, when everyone's getting up and saying, I support the Jensen alternative, like, how would you move that event into building real political power? And maybe you didn't know how to do that, or maybe you were alone in the room, right? And you just went home, and it's like, well, I don't know what to do after this point.
So you tell me, because I actually still don't know what to do. You tell all the listeners, you're in a situation like this, you're at some meeting, you say something, it resonates with a certain number of people in the room. Okay, what do you do next?
Well, the very first step is you need a working group of people who are going to really commit to this topic, to both educating and organizing the public around this topic, but not from a pleading perspective, right? We're taking our authority. We are the sovereign people, right? That's why I said in my little monologue at the beginning of our conversation, it requires a lot of public educating and organizing. And that's what most people don't know how to do, right? So there's a lot of skill building involved, because at this point, people think that activism is hitting a button on their computer screen and signing an online petition. You know, I did my duty for the day, right? So, you know, what I call the arts of democracy are these things that almost no one pays attention to anymore. Like, how many people have a positive experience in regular meetings of an organization, right? Like, where some people dominate and some people are, they whine a lot, there's conflicts in the group, certain people hold more power than others, women feel shut down by men, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, at the basic level of democratic decision making in a local group, how do you even function in a way that people feel positive about the experience of showing up every week to do real organizing in a group, right? And then it's like, okay, and does anyone know how to write a press release? Does anyone know how to speak publicly? Does anyone know how to talk to a local elected official or a state representative? No, almost no one knows how to do any of these things. If we're already feeling powerless in our own lives, right? We're already feeling overwhelmed and shell-shocked in this crazy world that we're living in that's getting scarier and scarier by the day, right? And then on top of that, you're being asked to learn all of these skills to be more effective, right? Which is hard. And maybe you're being asked to shell out money that you don't have to go to a class to learn these skills, which for some people is probably impossible. Like, what I'm saying is that there's all these natural barriers in the way, right? And so, and we're now so isolated from each other culturally, we need to create a culture of defiance and resistance and solidarity that has kind of been broken from us. It's like when the labor movement was 30 or 40% of workers, there was this, people still understood what cultural solidarity felt like in their bones. And now that it's like 9 or 10% of people are unionized and most of the unions are corrupt, who even understands the meaning of real solidarity anymore in their lives, right? So there's like, I'm not saying that any of this is easy. This is hard work. But I would be willing to be one of, let's say, 6 or 8 or 10 people who made a 5-hour-a-week or a 10-hour-a-week commitment for the next 2 years, let's say, to be part of a core group that started to organize on a larger scale around dam removal in the lower Columbia River, right? Reaching out to, like, who are the experts that we would really like to work with who aren't going to take over, right? But who have incredible expertise, right? What constituencies in the local community, like, for example, the urbanized native people would be immediately amenable to being part of something like this. The local tribes on their own, you know, postage stamp sized ridiculous reservations. Those people have always been in defense of salmon, right? Environmental groups, unfortunately, are so addicted to their like emergency activism, single issue activism, pleading with power holders rather than taking power, right? That, you know, boycotts and petitions and, you know, partnership agreements with giant corporations that are killing us. I mean, that's more what corporate leaders, what nonprofit leaders do these days, right? And you know this as well as anybody. And your latest book is a perfect example of that, right? So, like, you need a core group of people who are willing to make a serious initial commitment, and you build from there. It's a lot of work. And you can't say, okay, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do 4 other activist topics at the same time in my life. It doesn't work that way. Right. But if every single person who's doing single issue activism right now around climate or healthcare or clear cut logging or, you know, occupation of other countries, if those people started rethinking the kinds of tactics and strategies that they're using and understanding that those tactics and strategies literally cannot work, and instead kind of mobilizing around taking power and authority, we'd actually be getting somewhere. You know, there's a terrific quote by Subcomandante Marcos, who was one of the spokespeople for the Zapatista liberation movement in Mexico. And he says, we wish not to seize power, but to exercise it. And to me, like, there isn't, you couldn't say something more powerful about what I'm talking about in fewer words than Marcos did. We wish not to seize power, but to exercise it.
Okay, so let's say that that some groups coalesce and they're able to get the studies done for how to do this. They've got the engineering in place, and they've got, you know, whether they get it through, you know, a magic donor or whether they get it through a bond or whatever, or a number of bonds, but they get the $10 million it would take to take out a dam, say, or $20 million, right. however much it takes. You know, all of a sudden for 15 minutes, Jeff Bezos gets a conscience or something. I don't know. It doesn't matter. The money magically arrives, or it doesn't magically arrive. You do it through selling brownies. I don't care. So you get the money, and then you have the heavy operators, the heavy machinery operators, ready to go. And the federal government says, no, you're not doing this. They get an injunction. And I mean, so let's say you've done all the hard work, and then the feds just say, oh, that's very nice, little boys and little girls, but tough beans for you. You don't get to do it. So what happens then?
So a couple of things. The good questions. So first of all, the feds aren't going to slam their fist down at that point. They're going to start way earlier than that. They're going to try to say at every early phase that you're building power, you can't do this.
And they'll try to seize the bank account if you do get a magic donor.
Absolutely. But you see, when you're, you know, when you just said, you know, you've done the studies with your experts, like, yes, you're pulling in experts, but these are not meetings just like a corporate board where you're just a tiny little group coming up with all sorts of solutions and then sharing it with a million local residents. This is a million local residents being invited to be part of a people's revolutionary process, a democratized project process, so that you'd have ongoing forums, ongoing, what was I calling them earlier? Citizen assemblies in every community, right? You'd be building power, right? You'd be signing people up left and right to be going door to door, right? To be bringing the news to neighborhood after neighborhood. You'd have people coming out of the woodwork to be making presentations in their local church group, or their local nonprofit group of some kind, right? So you're building power across communities. And so I just lost my train of thought.
So this would not be then, you know, 17 heavy machinery operators that you've hired, but this would instead be 17 heavy machinery operators plus 100,000 people standing with them.
Exactly. Right. Because exactly. This is coming. This is like you're building people power and the expertise is feeding into the people power rather than just separating itself from those stupid people who think they're getting powerful. Right. The whole thing is democratized.
So right? this.
So for example, can I just give you one ahead. Quick example of something that's real? The participatory budgeting movement that started in Bolivia, I think, or Ecuador, I forget. It started in a city, I believe in South America, where a percentage of the city's annual budget was turned over to a citizen assembly process where the public is invited to sit down in meeting after meeting, well-facilitated meetings, careful notes taken, to how do you want to spend 5% of the city's annual budget next year? $5 million, $20 million, whatever it is, like real money. And people show up in large numbers, and the participatory budgeting movement is sweeping the world. Portland is about to finally get a participatory budgeting process, but Chicago had it, has had it for years. You know, we're in, it's like, and they even say the people who can come to the meeting. So people come to assembly after assembly and neighborhood after neighborhood, and they build consensus around how the money should be spent. And once there's a basic agreement, that goes to literally a public vote. And they let, in many cases, they let anybody 14 and older be part of the vote because they were part of the conversation. And then you get this massive consensus through a public vote. This is how we want to spend the money. And then the money is spent in that way, right? Which then empowers people to actually feel like showing up actually made a difference, which is so rare. I mean, how often do you go to a public hearing and you walk out feeling better than when you walked in, right? You usually walk out feeling pissed.
I don't know if I've ever been to a public meeting where I walked away feeling like, oh, the Forest Service is going to stop clear cutting.
Exactly. Because the decision making is all being held in the wrong hands. And we need to delegitimize the Forest Service's decision making. We have to delegitimize the USDA's decision making. We have to delegitimize the Health Insurance Corporation's decision making. It's all a violation of we the people's rights, right? And so the activism has to fundamentally change. And then we're all doing the same work. We're all doing democracy protection work to shift where the decisions are being made, by who, in what process, right? So the participatory budgeting movement is spreading around the world very quickly. And it's one of those rare examples. Somebody had a good idea. It was tried. It worked really well. And now it's spreading. So this is something very similar. And so in the same way with how do you raise $20 million? Well, if you've got 50,000 people in the city of Portland, which is like 10% of the city, I don't know if that's realistic, but let's say it is. If 50,000 Portlanders are paying attention to this campaign, they're donating. Maybe the money's right there, right? Who knows? But you're building political power of people who are taking authority to be part of the decision making. So when by the time an injunction comes from a court, you're like, screw the injunction. The federal government is required to serve we the people. And when it does not serve we the people, its decision making is illegitimate. That's what you say to the judicial system at that point. Get out of our way. Either support this democratic process, which is entirely working within the constitutional structures that are on the books, or get out of our way, right? To get to a point where the public has that level of understanding of their own power.
That's great. And that would be a perfect place to end, but I want to tell one story if I can tell it without crying.
Please.
Which
maybe
is
maybe tell it with crying, which is maybe even better.
One of the things that the Baltic states sorry. One of the things the Baltic states did during the collapse of the Soviet Union was they built a human chain across the entire country of all the people in those nations. And there's nothing the Soviets could do about it, you know, when you've got that level of resistance. And yeah, there had been people fighting in the woods by themselves in small groups for decades. But at some point when the time was right, the Soviets could not stand up to the entire nation. And it would be the same thing. I'm getting what you're saying about, yeah, if there's 15 of us and we somehow got $20 million, they just throw an injunction. And then if they don't like us, they, you know, they stand there and we stand there and then the whole thing's done. But if you've got all of the people in the region, then they're SOL. They being the government.
Absolutely. I mean, just even something as simple as Prop 215, right? The federal government couldn't stop them. They passed an illegal law. because it was we the people voting by majority. And once it was passed, all the state police authorities have to defend the state law, not the federal law. Right? I mean, you see people in Ukraine standing up. It's like, I'm watching people in Ukraine every day on the news saying, I love my country, I'm going to defend it. I'm like, you almost never hear a person in the United States talking with that level of passion about this place. Like, we barely know what it feels like anymore.
And
some exceptions.
And, you know, I'm not really interested in, and I know you're making this distinction, but we have to make this distinction between the government and the land and our community.
Mm-hmm.
That's a distinction I think we all need to understand. And we only have like 30 seconds left, so just wrap this up, please.
Oh, all right. Well, I want to urge people, if you're excited about this conversation, I just wrote a book. That's a great way to introduce yourself more deeply to these ideas. It's called How Dare We? Courageous Practices to Reclaim Our Power as Citizens. Go to communityrights.us to learn more about it. It's on the homepage, communityrights.us. That's the group I co-founded in 2017. Get the book, read it, talk to us. Maybe we can do a part two live stream for anybody who has heard this interview or this conversation.
And then one last thing, which is, so somebody is living in Tuscaloosa and they desperately love the endangered freshwater clams, one of the most endangered groups on the planet, and they don't know what to do. They don't like what's happening. But after reading the book and going to your website, how does one actually start to put this in place?
Call us at communityrights.us.
And you'll walk.
Absolutely. We'll send you resources. We'll do a live conversation with you to get you going.
Okay.
Communityrights.us, and the book is How Dare We? Please, folks, if you're excited about this, take the next step. Commit some time and energy to this.
Well, thank you so much for that, Paul, and thanks for your decades of Hall of Fame work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Paul Sinfuegos. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.